Cause if they don't have too much on their plate, the Kings of Combat Sports Podcast, John and Wade, they'll talk about the things they did that day. The land of life, the work of Triple H.
Rwanda SmackDown, 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 Rwanda SmackDown.
It's John Pollock and Neil Flanagan. We are diving into Rewind, a theme, Rewind, a SmackDown. That's right, everyone. We're coming at you in stereo, coming at you with the 1-2 punch. That is John Pollock and Neil Flanagan. Neil, we have quite the SmackDown to dissect. I have not had a chance to ask you yet this week, but you know, since we spoke on night one, how much of did you consume all of night two, and sort of what was your wrestling threshold? Were you overdosing by Monday, and how were you going into tonight's SmackDown when it came to intrigue in the follow-up on the SmackDown side?
I was definitely overdosing by Monday, that's for sure. I did completely consume WrestleMania night two live, and the post show afterwards live with the one night return of Mr. Ting, and so, you couldn't miss that, you know. So my thoughts were the same as most people's, so I'll not belabor that point, which is that the main event of Sunday kind of sucked. That's all I'm going to really say about it. By the end of Raw on Monday, my queue of wrestling from the weekend has kind of lapsed a little bit. There was a lot that I wanted to catch up on, but I'd had wrestling up to the gills at that point, and over on Disney Plus, the new series of Andor, the new Star Wars spin-off show, had landed, and I thought, well, let's have a change of pace and dive into that, because they dropped three episodes at once to begin. So, I took a bit of a break from wrestling. So I was ready for SmackDown again tonight after that palate cleanser.
I went through, I think, 8 days straight of just nothing but watching wrestling, and last night I finally got to just sit down and catch up on Survivor, and that was my reprieve from professional wrestling for one night. So I'm now all caught up on Survivor.
When you say catch up, is it more than one episode that you needed to consume?
Well, last week I had to just. I mean, these are 90 minute episodes. Yeah. Survivor is way too long. I will 60 minute show would be fine. So I watched the Tribal Council portion of last week's show, and then I watched the full edition of Wednesday's show. So I will not spoil for anyone out there, but it was a very good episode, a good twist at the end in terms of the elimination and how we're starting to, we have the final month now of this season, and it's are the jocks going to be outdone by the brains? That's the big question now. The balance of power is shifting, Neil.
I enjoy the range of your interests, John, you know, from sort of semi-academic kind of level books to what some might say was trashy reality television.
Well, it's
defend it.
Sometimes I need to just turn, you know what, Survivor, I won't even say I turn my brain off. I get great enjoyment out of this. It's more so it's to me, it's such a well done edited reality show. Like, yeah, they are, the way they're able to weave all of these stories, and like, just think of the thousands of hours of footage. You can go so many different directions, but it's making it cohesive and building up to who is going to be eliminated. And you dangle, like, it's basically you go in the Tribal Council and they introduce like two or three people that might be a threat, and you build up like where the alliances are going to go. And it's really that to me is like maybe my favorite part of Survivor. Beyond, like, you want strong personalities, but to me it is the way that they are able to convey these, like, the drama and the conflict. It's very well done.
I think I agree with you that it's you know, it's not I'm being a devil's advocate, but to edit those things and tell a compelling story is no mean feat. And my equivalent of that over here is the BBC version of The Traitors, where they just put people in a castle, and it's basically kind of a real life murder mystery show. There's an American version, which I don't particularly care for, because they put reality TV stars into it rather than just ordinary members of the public. And again, they must have just days and days of footage to try and craft an hour of really compelling TV, and they do a good job. I that's my sort of weak spot.
What's your level of interest in this British version of Saturday Night Live that is getting thrown out there as a possibility?
My interest level is high. But they've tried it before under different names. They never licensed the Saturday Night Live brand, but we had shows that were live on a Friday night on our Channel 4 in the UK, which was very much in that mold, you know, kind of currently popular comedians doing their spots, introducing musical acts, all of that. It was very much in the SNL template. But my interest level is high. We've got some very good homegrown comedians, Irish comedians, UK comedians, who I think could hold it down. It's such an American institution. It'll be interesting to see how it translates. We know that sometimes when things cross the Atlantic, either direction, it doesn't really work. But I'm very intrigued.
I'm interested to see it if it fully makes it and gets out there as well. One thing as well. So Neil and I on Thursday, we dropped our third edition of the book club. This month we chatted about Hell in Boots, which is the not about a woman named Helen Boots, but rather Hell in Boots by Soraya. And it's a really it's a tough read in some senses that Neil and I went through here. Like, she goes through a lot of trauma that she has sustained in her life, some that is known and giving further context to it, and other things that I am not aware she has ever spoken about publicly as well. In a nutshell, Neil, what did you kind of expect going into this book? And did you come away with it with like a kind of different perspective of Soraya, a similar one, and overall just kind of what you thought in terms of this as a book for a wrestling audience too?
What I knew about her really was what I'd seen sort of come through social media, come through news reports and the sort of entertainment press, and of course through the film Fighting With My Family. I had not seen the documentary, which inspired Dwayne Johnson to make, you know, to his production company to make Fighting With My Family. So I knew somewhat, you know, about her upbringing, a very unconventional sort of small family wrestling promotion in the UK, and that she was young when she, you know, landed in the US. Some of the sex tape stuff, of course, and I expected that story would be told. As you said, there was some childhood trauma there that she goes into. She doesn't really spare the reader too much detail and it's quite a visceral read. And I wasn't really expecting that level of being sort of sucker punched with this happened, you know. I think the conclusion I came to was, if you're interested in Soraya as a person, it's a very good read and I would recommend it. If you're not, then it's perhaps not, you know. That would be how I'd sum it up.
And I forgot to do our final segment on the show, which is, what are you reading, Neil? And are you in the midst of any other books right now, or any recommendations that you can give to the audience at large here?
Well, just quickly, there's a book, and it's been out for a very, very long time, called Mouse, M-A-W-S, by Art Spiegelman. And this is, it's a graphic novel, not a prose book. And it was the first graphic novel ever to win the Pulitzer Prize. And it's in two parts. It was originally sort of published in magazines.
Talking.
Yeah, okay. And it's largely in two parts. The first part is basically a family kind of history of him talking to his father, who was an Auschwitz survivor.
I found it.
There it is.
I've got it.
The second part of the book is a history of his family's experiences in the concentration camp. It's a pretty heavy read.
Oh, yeah. I read this in university. Yes.
It came to mind because in this second Trump administration, there have apparently been more book bans. And this, for some reason, has been pulled from some school districts, apparently because of language or like a depiction of nudity. And we were talking about sketches here, you know. It's insane, because this is a really original and excellent kind of not only depiction of the what went on in the concentration camps, but also in Spiegelman's own family. So I picked it up to reread recently, and it's a very high recommendation from me. And John owns it too, so come on.
Oh, maybe a future book review. You know, I can tell that our following of the book club is starting to intensify. I'm now getting contacted by people that have put out books that are requesting that we review. I mean, it's we have a very, very high threshold when it comes to our selection process that we go through.
It's great news. And today, in fact, while I was watching SmackDown, I think I got one of the few apps I still keep alerts on for is Blue Sky, because I don't get bothered very much by that. And there was a mention by Gordon, shout out Gordon, who has started All the President's Men, which is what we're going to be reviewing in May.
Yes, next month is the big test. We're doing a non-wrestling book. It is All the President's Men by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. So I'm looking forward to chatting about that one with Neil. So that's coming up next month. The book club is available to all Double Double and Espresso members on the cafe. And I'm going to repeat for those that are on the YouTube channel, on tonight's show, if you jump on board, get the XL edition of this show, Neil and I will be continuing after the SmackDown review with a special look at this new episode of Hollywood Demons on The Real Iron Claw, focusing on the Von Erich family. So back half of the show for cafe members, we will be reviewing that episode after SmackDown. So there you go. That is all of the house cleaning. And now we are going to move over to Fort Worth, Texas, where SmackDown took place at the Dickies Arena. Not the Dickie Bird Arena, but the Dickies Arena. 10,000.
Dickie has his ranch. He's got a new kid. Now he's got a sold out arena.
Yeah, real estate, Texas real estate. Just a picture of him, the logo of him, like on a horse at the Dickies Arena in Fort Worth. WrestleTex reporting 10,942. They did call it a sellout on the broadcast, and noting that the final hour would be commercial free, featuring the TLC match that they had announced last week. So we get a recap of WrestleMania, and John Cena begins the show and seems to be the part of the act now, is coming out and addressing Mark Nash to redo his introduction. And we get the dueling chance for Cena while he is in his color scheme for Texas with the old Dallas Mavericks color scheme and logo. And he is interrupted by Randy Orton before he can speak. They come out. They have known each other for 25 years. And he says that Orton says, "You had never changed this whole time until recently." It's like, this guy was a bodybuilder. He was a rapper. And then he changed many times over the years. You just weren't paying attention, Randy. And he says that, you know, there's all these kids out there that set their goals to be like Cena and looked up to you. It has to mean something to you, Cena. And I know that you've granted more wishes than anyone. There's a void because of this. And you know what? To fill that void, you need to have some damn kids. You need to grow up, be a father, and you'll become a better human being. It's like, what a weird ask of Randy here. I mean, this in a modern society, this is absolutely overstepping. And Cena comes back, how dare you, and accuses Randy of parent shaming him and says, "I don't have kids because I spent the last 25 years raising yours," as he directs his anger towards the audience. "And I've done an impeccable job. I've been a parent to your kids more than you could ever be." And he looks at a kid in the front row, calls his dad a loser, and then says, "The six-year-old just gave me the middle finger," and warns this child not to bring a knife to a gunfight. Orton states that the fans are the reason for his success, the reason that Cena is here. Orton says, "I'm like old furniture here. I'm here to stay. You're just a guest." Cena says, "I never needed these people." In the same breath, they say, "Let's go, Cena," and then follow with, "Cena sucks." They're all hypocrites. These fans are allowed to take their energy and put it all behind another star. But when I decide to put my energy elsewhere, suddenly I'm an outcast. This is why it's a dysfunctional relationship. Orton mentions that wrestling has given him everything. Well, Cena wants to ruin it and says that he is going to take this title. And by taking this title away and ending the lineage, because this title has never been vacated in its entire history, not once, never, it will freeze Randy Orton's number at 14. Now, let's forget that that is a number comprising variations of the world championship in WWE, but stay with John here. He says that WWE can create some tinfoil title to replace the real one, but I'm going to erase your family, three generations of your family history. So he's going to be doing a big Control-Alt-Delete on pro wrestling history when he leaves with this belt. Orton wants the title match right now, but Cena, being a better booker, suggests they do this match with several weeks of promotion in Randy Orton's hometown. And Randy is not fighting for Fort Worth anymore. He's like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And says, this is the closest you'll ever get to this belt, Randy. And then tosses it to Randy and jumps him and goes for a belt shot when it's ducked. And Randy gets the last laugh here with the RKO. And Randy hoists up the championship and, that is probably the closest that Randy is going to come to this title. But, dude, this was a 20-plus minute segment to start off the show, and this was commercial-free as well. So a lot of dialogue here. What did you think about setting up Cena and Orton and their the role reversal here than their past interactions?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that 2 weeks tomorrow is Backlash, so they don't have much time. So yeah, let's get this show on the road sort of thing with these two. And I think it was a good segment. We just have to wipe from our minds now with the sort of Men in Black clicker that Dwayne Johnson was ever anything to do with anything, you know, in the run up to Cena winning this title.
That's kind of what I think Dwayne Johnson was trying to do this week on Pat McAfee.
Indeed, yeah. So we just have to deal with Cena as he is. He's turned on the fans. He never needed them. It's a dysfunctional relationship, and he's just sort of woken up and realized that this year. And if you can buy into that, then, you know, this is a decent start to the next program. And being in St. Louis, you know, it's a natural enough opponent for him. It did feel like a long segment, but I think they both did good mic work here. Did you feel any differently, John? Or
no, I thought it was fine for the segment they had. With Cena, it's like I'm liking a lot of the material. It's sometimes that I still get a feeling of Cena almost like pantomiming, like he's inherit, like these are my, I'm playing my heel role as I am supposed to be doing it. And, you know, he's very good in this role. I wouldn't even say like I'm necessarily nitpicking it, but I don't think he's the natural heel promo that he has been as just as John Cena for all of these years. Like there is to me a bit of like, I'm putting on this character and I'm doing it well, but it is a very, it's very much a playing a role kind of character, but the audience is responding to it. And I think this is a match that on 2 weeks' notice, I think people are going to be interested in. They haven't seen it in a long time. You have the dynamic of the hometown, and it's always the toughest for the challenger that is challenging the new champion after Mania on that pay-per-view. Yeah. And it's even doubly so now because like the whole heat is Cena keeping this belt all year long. I mean, you have to really work overtime to get any of these, like that audience in St. Louis to bite on these near falls. And I think on top of it is that Cena performance at WrestleMania. Like what kind of match are you going to get in this one? Like you watch that match and it's not like, okay, he just had a bad night. I think it's like, this is what John Cena is working with in 2025. Yeah. And like going 25 minutes with Randy Orton, I would not be booking that length of a match. And will audiences be accepting of a, you know, much quicker and all the like having your Death Riders House of Torture type of booking or getting out of things like with a DQ to just get heat with people? It is a bit of a tricky match to book when Cena does need to keep this belt.
Yeah, and we haven't really established any goons for Cena. He doesn't really have a stable, so the bells and whistles, you wonder where in 2 weeks those could come from. Please God it's not Travis Scott reappearing because that went down like a lead balloon, you know. I will say I think also this Fort Worth crowd were very compliant, very, you know, they weren't going to hijack at all. They weren't going to cheer Cena tonight. He got pretty thoroughly booed on his entrance. They did do the dueling chants thing, but that's basically everyone does that. So they felt like they were sort of on side with this program. And no doubt that will be the case for Orton on the pay-per-view as well. And then I think it probably behoves the whole company to let let Cena disappear with the title for a little while, because, you know, wait till the run-up to SummerSlam maybe, or the, for the next thing, because week to week, this isn't wonderful stuff, because we all know he's just going to keep the title for a bit, quite a bit.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
The first match of the show, Los Garza is out, and they are taking on the, I guess we can say now debuting. We've seen appearances from each individually, but it's Fraxium together, and this was the call-up. And are you... What was your thought on Axiom getting brought up on SmackDown as opposed to Raw?
An interesting move, I thought. I mean, Raw has a very light tag division. And as we get to the end of this show, we can see that SmackDown doesn't. And does SmackDown really need another really talented, high-speed, high-action, exciting tag team where, in, you know, with Raw you've got the War Raiders, New Day, and I think Waller and...
Theory.
And yeah. Theory, and that may be it. I'm probably forgetting, you know, others who could be put together and others who are around. But, yeah, I'm surprised that it was SmackDown that gone to.
Yeah, I mean, selfishly, there's a lot of great matches that you can make. Like, even Los Garza, like, you throw them into this mix on SmackDown. There's a lot of great matches that you can make. It's just, it's so barren on Raw, conversely. So it's sort of like feast and famine with these tag divisions. I still maintain your idea of, I think, just unifying these tag titles would do a lot for both sides of the divisions.
With you know, the same stipulation as the women, with being able to travel between brands and, you know, set up matches with whoever.
So Fraxium hit these suicide dives early on, and then Fraser hits a Topikon Hero, and there's the golden triangle off the top by Axiom. Angel pulls down the rope, so Axiom crashes, and then Fraser makes this insane comeback. He is going at a speed that is ridiculous, and it ends with a quebrada, and in midair, upside down, is super kicked by Angel. They hit a super MTY off the buckle. Berto is then hits the moonsault. Axiom saves, and Fraxium get control of Angel. One-man Spanish fly by Axiom and the Phoenix Splash by Frazier for the pin in 8 minutes and 25 seconds as they get the rightful call-up. And I think that for them, I mean, there's a lot of great teams to work here on SmackDown, and I think that they will be a highlight for this show. I mean, this does beef up the show that is 3 hours, so I'm not complaining in that regard.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've seen better matches with Fraxium, but this was a very good debut. Like you said, 9 minutes or so. And the pace of these guys is pretty breathtaking. I thought that you sometimes wonder how invested the crowd are in NXT talent when they arrive. And it did seem kind of silent at the beginning, but they certainly caught them and, you know, got the "this is awesome" chants and all the rest of it by the end. I wonder, though, sometimes, and this is a bit parochial, when the announcers are promoting something that is for the US audience only, it seems to be muted on the international feed on Netflix. So I don't know whether the crowd were silent at the beginning or whether it's just we're not hearing anything from the desk, you know, because you get the first few words of them saying, if you're hungry, and you know they're going into a Snickers promo or something like that, and then you just don't hear the rest of it.
Yeah, it's kind of this abrupt silence that you get on the international feed. Tiffany comes out still wearing the effects of this match with Charlotte Flair, where she's just got this like dent on her forehead from Saturday. Just got rocked there. When she name dropped Charlotte Flair, who was absent from the show, Flair was soundly booed. And she says, "Sometimes the pressure got to me, but in the end, I prevailed. People said that you are the next Charlotte Flair. Well, that's not true. There's one Charlotte Flair, and there's only one Tiffany Stratton." And before she can move on, Jade Cargill comes out, calls the match she had with Charlotte Flair impressive. I wouldn't say that. And now you've got a bigger target on your back. And my business with Naomi is finished. That means it's not. And I have come here to become champion. So Stratton says, "Well, how about right now?" And, you know, Tiffany Stratton not booking like John Cena. She's just going to hotshot this this match. And we get a referee out. And we get Tiffany Stratton against Jade Cargill on 3 minutes' notice. And Jade catches her. I thought they had a lot of timing issues at various points in this match that they were, you know, it kind of was just... Like, this felt like they had 3 minutes to get ready for this match. That's kind of the feel that this had at one time. And then we get the spot where after a handspring into the back elbow, Tiffany goes for, she hits a rolling senton and then slips on the prettiest moonsault ever and just has to redo it on the fly. And Wade is just going on and on, paying attention to this. Like, that means Tiffany's hurt, and he's just trying to weave it into the story. Jade would catch her with a superplex when, first of all, the really strongest spot here was as Tiffany went for a cartwheel and Jade stopped her as she's overhead and turns it into a sit-out powerbomb. And the crowd really did react to that. It's when Jade can do these power spots and, more importantly, out of nowhere power spots. Yeah. That seems to be the where things really gel for the audience that they get into. We saw that at Mania, and it was the case in this match too. But before she can follow that, after a superplex, Naomi runs out in a caution tape bodysuit, which might be Brayden's Halloween costume coming forward. And she attacks Jade and laughs maniacally as she runs her shoulder into the post multiple times, and the DQ comes at 10 minutes and 12 seconds. Stratton then comes back in, stares down Naomi, who leaves, and then as Stratton is left in the ring, the returning Nia Jax, the Roastmaster, attacks Tiffany Stratton from behind and shares a look with Naomi and proceeds to leg drop and hit the Annihilator onto Tiffany Stratton. So it feels as though we're going to be going with a return program for Tiffany and Nia Jax, and we're going to run back Naomi and Jade as well on top of this. So it seems like a lot of pairings that will be staying together and several others later in the show.
Yeah, same here. That looks like the direction we're going in with these four. I agree with you, John, that the match was a little bit clunky. I didn't mind so much Wade banging on about the slip, because it was very obvious. It was front and center on camera, so they can't really cover up for it. So he, you know, they did their best to sort of say, well, you know, I mean, she's not the same person, you know, as she was after WrestleMania. You know, that was a fight, you know, not a match. And Jade, I think, is still coming along. And I agree with you. Like, the power spots, the shoulder tackles, the basic stuff, you know, that's good for somebody who's big and powerful like she is and has that stature. And I don't think she needs to be the best worker in the world. And if she can master some of those catches into a power spot, that's great too. But yeah, there's some timing stuff and selling stuff, but I do think she's markedly better than when she arrived and than when she was in AEW. So, you know, I'll give her credit certainly that she's leveling up.
And no Charlotte Flair on the show. This was the only mention of her as well. I think that's an interesting one of just where you go with Charlotte Flair after what was a pretty definitive loss and very clearly her Tiffany moving on to her next program. Like, what you do with Charlotte after this. Yeah. Like, I think now that you assess this whole thing, I think this is kind of your going back to the drawing board and assessing this whole return that, I mean, the promo segment, which on the night just felt like this train wreck, ended up being kind of a benefit in the moment, but I think the match on the weekend I think overall leaves us on a pretty negative note, and I'd say that's where a lot of people are on the Charlotte Flair front at this point, since I just think this comeback, a lot of things have not worked out. I don't think the creative has been there for her. I think she's been thrown off by a lot, like some of these crowds, and I don't think it's been her best work. It's just been a whole litany of problems to me.
Even this week, you know, sort of off screen, I think, you know, that she's sort of seems to have expressed some dissatisfaction with what was, you know, said about her at the roast. The entire audio of that is now out there somewhere, and I haven't been bothered to listen to it because the clips I've heard have just been unbelievably unfunny. I'm not averse to roast humor. It's meant to be edgy. It's meant to be sort of, and there's kind of a contract between the roastee and the roasters, but this was not that. It's just a collection of terrible jokes.
I've only skimmed through it. Like, there's no way I'm going to get through the whole thing. I mean, it's, you know, in terms of some of the material, it's like, listen, like, it is a roast, and that is what that audience is expecting. And I think that if you're participating in this, it's kind of fair game. I guess your gray area is talent that had nothing to do with this. And now this audio is out there as well. It's one thing if this had totally stayed self-contained, but it's not surprising at all that everyone was curious to hear this, and it made its way out, and it's going to be out there. And that's what WWE signed up for. Like, that was what the gig was for this roast. But you do have that element to it as well. That is sort of what you had put out there for people. And then you have talent that like had nothing to do with this. And you are in any kind of roast situation, there's going to be people that catch strays that don't have anything to do with it. It was the same for the Tom Brady roast. Yeah. And it was the same for this one as well. Charlotte Flair included. Jacob Fatu and Solo Sikoa were out next. Jacob Fatu feels like a total superstar coming out of this weekend. Like, he was already sort of on that path. And I think the reception to the match and just this guy's unmitigated charisma came out, and it really shined in this segment. He's out with Solo Sikoa, and they cheer Fatu and boo Solo Sikoa. And Solo takes the mic and says, "No one in my family wanted Jacob here except me. They thought he was too much trouble. I'm the reason Jacob is champion. I took him to the promised land." And with that, Fatu yanks the microphone around. He says, "I told you I would win this title with or without you. This title makes me America's most wanted, a menace to society." And he's just going on, "You better get in where you fit in." And he is going to get this over so much. Fatu. He's just doing his own like, ooh, so. And I mean, this guy, his catchphrases are there. It's like chantable stuff that he is introducing. And he gets cut off by LA Knight. And Knight comes out and said that, you know, "Everyone told me I had a hell of a match on the weekend, but I don't care about having a hell of a match. I care about winning, and I want a rematch right now." So Drew McIntyre is out next, and he explains, "Damian Priest was my last roadblock and one of the most violent matches in WrestleMania history."
Yeah.
Yes.
I take issue with that.
The censored version is going to have to be made for Netflix to continue streaming this thing. And then says, "You will not see Damian Priest for a while, and it was a pleasure to embarrass him in front of his family." Then he said, "I was going to challenge John Cena, but Orton jumped the line. What is this, Nepo wrestling entertainment? Speaking of which, here's the bloodline." And LA Knight is yawning in the corner at this long promo. Drew walks up to Jacob Fatu. He wants to face him, the baddest dog in the yard. And Knight cracks a joke. Drew says, "Your United States title run was a joke." Meanwhile, Knight cannot even remember Drew's last title run. And so they all want to fight. Nick Aldis comes out, and he announces later tonight, LA Knight and Drew McIntyre to determine the number one contender. Why? Because Nick Aldis, who is, he forgets at the best of times how to book a final hour, but now he's got a commercial free one to book. So he needs LA Knight and Drew McIntyre to face off later tonight. And we'll go into where this one is going. But to me, I thought the standout of this segment was Jacob Fatu. And I just see this guy as being, if you're looking kind of at your big projects post WrestleMania that can make that leap, I think it's Bron Breakker and Jacob Fatu who are at the front of that line.
For sure. And this is one sort of area where the brand split kind of works, you know, because you've got Braun up on Raw being elevated, and Fatu here is, looks like he's ready for the top of the card almost. You know, he's got a secondary title, but the crowd absolutely adore him. And I think, I wonder where this will all end up, you know. I feel like the dynamic of booing Solo, who's trying to take credit for dragging this guy off the streets and bringing him onto television, and Fatu, you know, there's something there, maybe, you know, something between the two of them. They could go in that direction eventually, but yeah, he's so over the catchphrase, the presentation, even the just the cool factor, the fact that, you know, the way he came out wearing the belt around his neck, sort of peering over it with the beanie on and all of that. He just looks the business. It's great.
Yeah, and we should note that last week they did the angle with Tama Tonga and slamming the car door on his hand. It was bodyslam.net that had reported that he is out with an injury. So, I mean, that appears to be the angle to write him off, and he was absent from this segment and from SmackDown on Friday. Saxton interviews Zelina Vega. She says she's speechless going into this match with Chelsea Green. She cites her mentors, Rey Mysterio and Eddie Guerrero, and she's not going home until she has that title around her waist. And that takes us to the Women's United States title match. Chelsea Green and Zelina Vega. The unprettier is attempted right away, and when Green distracts the ref, it's Niven getting involved with a senton. They continue to work over Vega, and then Vega stops a superplex and Germans Green off the middle turnbuckle. Joe Tessitore mentions that Zelina Vega is 0-5 when going for championships. It was exactly at that moment, Neil, that I wrote down, we are getting a title change. When the, when those stats come out, that is almost always a tell, most times. Meteora is hit by Vega for a two count, and then Elba gets knocked off the apron, and Niven and Fire continue to get involved when the Secret Hervis are finally ejected, and Green gets sent off the ropes into a code red, and Zelina Vega pins Chelsea Green in 7 minutes and 15 seconds, runs off with the belt as Niven and Fire return. So Zelina beats Chelsea Green 3 weeks in a row with the errant count out, last week's non-title, and then wins the title match.
Yeah. Not the best wrestling match I've ever seen. Well, that's putting it mildly. But, you know, I have to be pleased for these people sometimes, because
she sold this like a really big deal. Like, she was like in tears. She's pointing up at like her father in the sky. Like, she sometimes it's the way that they register like these title wins, especially when for these performers, like especially when it's their first title, it means a lot to some of these people to win titles that that we are not going to always really look at the same level of significance with. But she really did sell this like a big deal, like you should.
Yeah, and that's my biggest takeaway from it was you know, the code red that won it wasn't the best and all the rest of it, but it was the post match. This, and we all know that the titles are won by booking, you know, not really by athletic competition, but this clearly meant a huge amount to her, and to see her in legitimate tears and pointing up, like you said, that, you know, you can't help but be pleased for the talent when they're elevated to a spot that's important to them. You know, even if the average viewer doesn't view this belt as especially important, you know, she is, you know, she's over the moon with this result.
And with Chelsea Green, I think, with or without a title, I think it's of no significance to her. Like, she's a staple that you can insert into anywhere you want on this show. And I think, especially on SmackDown in this format, I think she's going to get plenty of focus with or without this championship.
Yeah.
Carmelo Hayes is with The Miz. I won't lie, I have not thought about this Andre the Giant Battle Royal once since we finished recapping it a week ago. So he is with the trophy. Miz says, you are going to be the greatest Andre the Giant Battle Royal winner ever. Mm-hmm. I have a vision. And then I'm like, how big of a deal are they really going to make this? And then The Miz presents him with this gold chain with the largest Andre the Giant face attached to it. The second I saw this, I was like, this is literally and figuratively going to be gold. I thought this was hilarious. He is going to have to wear this thing every week. Get rid of the giant trophy and just wear this chain every week. And Carmelo is now the 10th wonder of the world. So he's got a nickname out of this, which means he's got a t-shirt out of this. Yeah. And Miz then announces he's got to go get something off his chest in the ring. Listen, I know a lot of people have been very underwhelmed with what Carmelo Hayes has done on the main roster, and I'm not saying that this is going to be much, but it is, like, all you will say is the Miz is doing everything in his power to get this guy over. And, yeah, like, you don't watch this. This is not this guy trying to, like, you know, cut off him at the legs, get his catchphrases in or stuff to be the spotlight of the segment. This guy is such an unselfish performer, and this whole task is get this guy over in Carmelo Hayes. And I think that, you know, it's at this point, it's kind of undercard comedy, but we will see where it goes.
Sure, yeah. This necklace is absolutely horrific.
I loved it. I laughed when I saw this thing.
I did too. Just the sheer size of the
It's
Andre
ridiculous. Pendant. Like, it's the most ridiculous chain you've ever seen in your life with Andre's face of all things. Like, this just, it's insane.
And how long before it appears on WWE Shop, I wonder?
Oh, I can't even imagine that by Monday there will not be pre-orders for this thing. So The Miz, who is all in a white suit, maybe as a nod to what was going to be happening here, gets into the ring and he cuts a promo about not having a match nor a mention at the highest grossing WrestleMania. I headlined, I beat John Cena at WrestleMania, something Cody couldn't do. I wasn't chosen by Ray to replace him, nor was I chosen to face Randy Orton. Instead, they chose an internet meme who does musical theater in a wrestling ring, which maybe Miz will be the one to show up at Rebellion. Maybe that's the best that they'll get. He then says, I am sick of people showing up here in this company that can't lace my boots and are not as big of a star as me. And with that, the lights go out. And Sabu comes out. No, it was the returning Aleister Black with his old classic theme. He has also gone through. He has registered his new government name from Malachi to Aleister. And he does he rises up the old classic entrance and comes out. When they recognized him, like, you got like the reaction. But as he's walking down, he enters the ring and the music stops and they get into the welcome back, and Miz just charges at him and gets hit with the black mass, and Black just sits down cross-legged. I don't want to give a poor representation of this segment, but this was not like this crowd lost their mind here either, which was, this is maybe the easiest segment. It's the surprise but not surprise return that we've been teasing. And it's it's the guy from the other company that's now coming back. They reacted, but this was not some wild reaction to this return. That the way this was all set up, it felt like they had expected this would be deafening, and I just didn't find it was.
Yeah, I agree. It was 4 weeks maybe of these teaser promos, and everyone knew who's coming back. Last week they had the date, so this crowd will have known ahead of time. We're going to see Aleister Black come back tonight. And like you said, he got the welcome back chance, but I don't know. Maybe they should have done something to freshen the character. That's my only thought, is that, you know, it's the same theme music as his old one. It's the same sort of backboard rising up entrance. The, the tumbling into the ring, into a cross-legged position. All of the presentation is exact, and those single contact lens, all of that is exactly as it was just before he parted ways with WWE, and here he is doing the same thing. And to just come back, hit Miz with a kick, and I don't know, it didn't seem...
Was the Miz the right person for this segment?
I wonder. I feel maybe not. He's too easy fodder for this sort of thing. But like you said, that doesn't really explain away the fact that the crowd didn't lose their shit when he came out, and they really didn't. You know, it took them a while to even realize, I think, what was happening. Then there was certainly loud cheers and...
Yeah, again, if you didn't see this segment, I don't want to say you could hear crickets here, but it's just the expectation level of, you know, a big return, and what we have seen, contrasted to even a Ricky Stark showing up at NXT, and granted it's a much smaller audience there, but it was I just thought this was not that big holy shit kind of moment that you would have been expecting just the way this was laid out. And if you had told me how this segment was laid out, I would have been like, yeah, this sounds like that'll be great. Black Mass, big end. But it just felt when the music ended, he's standing there and it's like finally the crowd, they just started escalating the welcome back chants, but it was almost like this, they're waiting for it to really pick up as well. So, you know, maybe it was a stunned crowd that said, hey, wait a minute. This guy just like, you know, had a send off with Adam Cole. And like, what was the big deal? It was like two guys have a great match and they just have some words afterwards. Okay. I didn't think he was leaving. I do await the Instagram video from Aleister Black after this. So quite the night, though, for husband and wife here in back-to-back segments.
Yeah. Crossed my mind as well, yeah.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Saxton interviews Bianca Belair, and she shows off her broken fingers from the match, but she's proud of what the three of them did at WrestleMania, says Io capitalized like she should have. Rhea slipped into the match that I had earned, but that's not the last time we'll meet. She's got to go heel, but my home is divided and I have some unfinished business when I return. And you didn't get as much as like the overt kind of heel tone from Bianca that we had had in the lead up to Mania and in the match. This felt more so of a, and I did like this fact that they're really making this women's match feel like it was like this classic match. They put the clip out of like Steve Austin coming up to Io Sky after the match and putting it over. And just here, like with Saxton putting this over, like as like the big match that I feel over time, this is going to be the match that people associate with this WrestleMania, maybe more so than the main event on the first night.
Yeah, I think at least on an equal footing with that, you know, if they're, and particularly when people look for the work rate match, if they're, you know, sometimes there isn't even one of those on some of the previous WrestleMania one night ones, that this was certainly that. And I think, you know, for me, it was the far and away the best match of the two nights. So I wonder how long she's going to be off for, and maybe they just want to be ambiguous about whether she's going to come back.
I mean, it's broken fingers. I mean, you wouldn't think it's going to be too long of a prolonged period. But obviously, like, you have this Naomi Jade story that you wonder if they were ready to move on with that, and they're just going to run that program back for this next pay-per-view cycle until Bianca's ready. Because it kind of, like, that match did not feel like it ended with a whole lot of need for the rematch. It was almost as though they expected Bianca would be, you'd extend that story with the three of them moving forward. Nia walks into Naomi and tells Naomi to stay out of my way when it comes to Stratton and the title. And Naomi warns her, as long as you proceed with caution. The catchphrase might be, I thought it was cute at the beginning. It is a little forced.
It's the only part of this character that I kind of cringe at a tiny bit, because I think she's doing such a good job with it. I love the video packages in particular where she's just unhinged.
Yeah.
And when she was yelling the other week, that really works. The outfits and...
You don't like the caution bodysuit?
I don't particularly love the caution tape thing, motif at all, you know, whether it's being said or whether it's part of the outfit. But anyway, that's a nitpick, because I'm really loving Naomi at the moment. She's done so well as a heel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. LA Knight, Drew McIntyre, number one contenders match. Somehow both of them ended up selling like their ribs in this match. Knight's just selling, and then it's Drew hitting the Glasgow kiss, and a future shot DDT is countered into a jackknife. Drew avoids the blunt force trauma, and then they go to the floor. He rams Drew's head into the desk. I mean, he couldn't be slapping this desk any harder. Solo then shows up, hits the Samoan spike to Knight, and the ref his back is turned, of course, so he doesn't see it, but Drew does. And Drew, unlike Cody, thinks about it for like half a second before he realizes, well, I'm going for the Claymore. And he sets up for the Claymore when Damian Priest shows up, yanking Drew out of the ring, attacking him for the DQ. After 9:25, he chokeslams Drew through the unbreakable desk. And then Priest and Knight start arguing when Fatu shows up and just dives onto both men, runs them into the post and steps. The crowd's all into Jacob Fatu. Yeah. And then he hits a pair of jumping moonsaults, one to Knight, one to Priest. Guy looked like a star on this whole show. And while it feels like they are keeping Drew and Damian together, this feels like a four-way coming out of it, which I'm much more intrigued than seeing another Jacob Fatu LA Knight program that came out of this. When Knight technically... So it was Drew wins this match by DQ. So I guess that's his claim to the title. And I just imagine all four of these will be thrown into this match together.
That was my takeaway as well. You know, when they nowadays on SmackDown run down the results toward the end. And so this was officially a Drew McIntyre win, but I don't think it's enough to get him the one-on-one title shot. So
I'm not really asking for either of the singles matches to be redone. Four-way, no. We'll take that. That's... You've got some good pieces there for a four-way.
Yeah.
John Cena's in the back, and he runs into R-Truth, who explains to Cena he's been his hero since the beginning, and to give him a call if you need anything. And with that, he just walks away. I guess we just had to do a John Cena-R-Truth segment together. Until one week where Cena's going to beat the hell out of this guy.
Yeah, that's and they need happen. To do that at some
yes.
point.
Jimmy Uso just walks in and says that John Cena's whack, and... Truth defends him and says he's going to be like Cena just when he grows up, just like Cena when he grows up. And Jimmy informs him that he's already grown up.
Yeah.
Great, great segment. That was Jimmy Uso's post-Mania SmackDown appearance. So next week we have the announcement, Aleister Black against The Miz in Des Moines, Iowa. But then it is time for the main event, the TLC match for the tag titles, Street Profits defending against DIY and the Motor City Machine Guns, commercial free. And Wade Barrett, he set this up really well. He's stating this could top anything we saw at WrestleMania, which, I mean, outside of a handful of matches, I don't know how much that is saying, but they really put this over. Like, all these six guys have a chip on their shoulder, and they're going to come out and prove to management you would have wanted this match on Mania. And I would say by the end, these guys made a hell of an argument that this would have been maybe a show saver if this had happened on night number one, for instance.
Yeah.
So just these six, this is the TLC ladder match concept to me. It's one of the hardest matches for me to really get into nowadays. I've seen 10 million of these matches. I feel like I've seen almost every conceivable idea out there. And this was a match where these six, it felt like they had the most ambitious plans. Like, let's go out there. Let's really introduce some creative spots that have not been seen before. And you had, I just thought, some remarkable ideas that were presented here. And the execution was stellar as well. So the crowd is super into this. We see Montez Ford, who, I mean, you could make arguments for everyone in this match, but man, Montez Ford, this felt like a career-making match for Montez sure. Ford in terms of who is going to be most remembered for some of the stuff in this match. He hits his regular dive over the corner while Dawkins is in the Tree of Woe, just landing on everyone on the floor. Then the ladders are brought in, and Gargano comes off one ladder with a spinning flatliner to Ford off the other ladder. Ciampa is then attacking the machine guns with chair shots to the back, and they do the evil spot where they put the chair around Shelley's neck and Gargano swings for the fences. Gargano sets up the chairs and puts them back to back to set up Dawkins, but it's turned into the silencer, and he takes the back bump. And the Profits do the Dudley Boy spot, get the tables, and this leads moments later to a super blockbuster doomsday device over the top to the floor that Ford executes coming over the top. This was nuts. Absolutely. And was caught too. They had the others there to catch him coming down. This was actually like it looked so spectacular, and they did it in a relatively safe fashion as well, but it looked incredible.
Absolutely incredible spectacle. Yeah. And just in general in this match, I was thinking, oh God, John's got to try and do play by play for this.
Dynamite gets me ready for these. This was nothing. But then Montez Ford grabs a weapon handed over by a fan, his prosthetic leg, And this crowd goes nuts when he uses the prosthetic leg as a weapon. Joe Tessitore, who I have plenty to say about Joe Tessitore, he just screams, "We've never seen anything like this." It's like, this literally was the Mad Dog Vachon spot that Kevin Nash utilized, but this was decades ago. So, I mean, it's not even, you can't even redo the prosthetic leg spot as something novel here. But man, did this get a great pop. And this fan was just in his glory that his leg was used as a weapon. Saban comes off the top, putting Dawkins through a table on the floor. And then Ford places Ciampa on a table, laid down on the floor. And Ford hits a Tope Cun Hero, putting him through the table. This, dude, the performance of Montez Ford was just incredible. Yeah. Ciampa ends up recovering moments later to hit a White Noise to Ford through a table, through a ladder bridge between the ring and the apron. They the machine guns put Gargano through a table on the floor with the skull and bones as Saban balanced himself on the table. And Ciampa climbs up, the ladder's pulled out, so he's doing the spot, the Devon spot, where he's hanging above the ring. Then they put a table underneath Ciampa as he's dangling. Dawkins comes up, channels Adam Copeland, and he hits a spear, putting Ciampa through the table. At this point, this match is just out of this world. Yep. Ford springboards onto the ladder, knocks Saban off, and it comes down to Ford, Gargano, and Saban, where Saban and Gargano are up the either side of the ladder, and Ford is climbing like the side of the ladder, knocks both down, and he is left to grab the belts. The Street Profits retain in 22 minutes and 52 seconds. This was an incredible match. This was one of the best TV matches that WWE has produced in a really long time. This was spectacular. I think this is a TLC match that will get remembered in like the sea of these types of matches. I just thought that this was, these six were out there to just have an all-time performance, and it was an incredible main event.
Yeah, I think there's definite truth in this notion that these six were out there to prove something tonight. You know, I mean, that's how it was set up, but I believe from this performance that that's true. The amount of work that must have gone into sort of laying out what was going to happen in this match, knowing that there were no commercials, no dead spots, no rest spots. I don't know if you got the timing of it, John, but it was like
22 minutes and 52 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it was lengthy too. And it was
which, let's be fair, they probably wouldn't have gotten that this time at WrestleMania. Even with that block, like, they're probably condensing this down significantly as well. And remember, like, the entrances and all that, like, this was much longer than 23 minutes. And I really like, whether they ended a few minutes early or not, I love that we had 3 minutes to go through the replays, the celebrations, the contrasting to the losers who are just like beside themselves, reeling from the loss. It really just, instead of just going off the air right after they grab the belts and you don't have time to digest what you've seen. And the other MVP of this match, this was the best match I've heard Joe Tessitore call in WWE. Like, and that's not saying, like, I enjoy Joe Tessitore. He was at another level in this match, and he was just so enthused, and like, he was in awe of this match. It was so evident, and that translated for me in a big way. Like, this is absolutely worth your time to watch this weekend if you skip SmackDown.
I was going
to
say, like, I mean, I don't blame people for not catching SmackDown on a regular basis, but this match, just make sure you catch it. It was the best match I've seen on television this week across any promotion. It's the best TLC match I've seen in years. I mean, if I rewind to this point last week when this match was announced, I was like, okay, I'm sure it'll be good. But, you know, they didn't get the WrestleMania spot. I'm sure it'll be okay. You know, it's just good workers in this match. But this went way above my expectation level. The time it got, the fact that there were no commercials was really to its benefit. The Motor City Machine Guns and DIY, I knew would be really good. The Profits really stepped up too. And as like you said, John, I think that Montez Ford was a real, like, almost a breakout performance for him.
It was
in this match. Yeah.
Like, I think this really takes the Street Profits to the next level, that they needed to have this kind of a match. And I mean, the Machine Guns and DIY, they were tremendous in this match. But yeah, some of the and Dawkins too, like that.
Yeah,
that spear off the top, putting Ciampa through the table. Like, they need to replay that stuff to the same degree you did with like Edge and Jeff Hardy. Like, it's sure. Granted, you don't have a stadium setting like that visual, and you'll get that comparison. But like, that's how these matches live on. It's like hammering these images to people over and over, and really making it a memorable match, because it was spectacular. Like, the everyone just did a great job, and the commentary was excellent as well. So this, I really thought this is the strongest I've felt after a 3-hour SmackDown, and people know my thoughts on the 3-hour SmackDowns, but this overall, like, you did get quite a lot for a post WrestleMania edition of SmackDown with the arrivals of Fraxium and Aleister Black. Unbelievable main event as well. So, I mean, just looking at like the addition too of like Fraxium to this tag division, like, again, it's like, it's a very thin tag division on Raw, but this is like an outstanding tag division that you do have the parts of on SmackDown, unless they are going to mix some of these teams, which almost feels like they have to at this point, because I think it's so lopsided.
Because if it stays this way, this match and the teams that are involved just elevates these tag titles so far above those world titles on Raw. I mean, on one hand, the Mania crowd would have gone absolutely crazy for this. But as you said, John, they were never going to get this length of time either if this had been on the Mania card. So I'm sort of, in the end, glad it worked out this way for them. And like you said, it's really memorable. I know that come the end of the year, particularly in the WWE box, this is going to be a match I'll remember.
Yeah. So there you go, everybody. A tremendous main event from SmackDown. And that is going to wrap us up on the YouTube channel. But I want to thank everyone that is here at youtube.com/postwrestling. Do want to let you know that you can jump on board postwrestlingcafe.com for $6 a month, and you will get all of our extra shows and the XL editions of shows like this, where we go through the news of the week at the beginning, and then we are going to be doing a special bonus on the cafe tonight as soon as we finish this, talking about the Von Erich episode of Hollywood Demons. So we will say goodbye to you, but if you're on the cafe, sit back. We are just beginning because now we have some feedback.